Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We begin today with the concept of new music as a tool for social change. Jared Tate and South Dakota Symphony Orchestra are one of only five composer and orchestra pairs selected to participate in Music Alive. It's a national three-year composer orchestra residency program from the League of American Orchestras and New Music USA. We'll meet Jared Tate later in the hour, but first we reached out to Delta David Geyer to help us understand the impact of having a composer embedded with the orchestra for an extended period of time. It's a conversation about imagination and community service, history, and how the humanities impact people and relationships. Here's Maestro Delta David Geyer.
There's an organization, national organization, called New Music USA. A few years back, it was a coming together of another organization called Meet the Composer and the American Music Center. And they service American composers in various ways, but they're also a granting organization. Music Alive is one of their programs, which is specifically for symphony orchestras. So they fund music for smaller ensembles, for individuals, and so on and so forth. So New Music USA funds individuals and smaller ensembles in different ways, but Music Alive is specifically their program for orchestras. And up until right now, it's been sort of smaller grants, and we have had a couple of residencies over the last few years. Last year we had a jazz composer from Seattle named Sumi Tanoka, who was funded by Music Alive. She was with us for a week. And about 5 years ago, Music Alive was with Jared Tate.
Right.
And it funded his Victory Songs, which is a song cycle for baritone and orchestra in the Lakota language. So I guess it was last June. Jennifer Boomgarten and I were at the League of American Orchestras conference in Baltimore, and we had like a half-day session with New Music USA and the other people who had been funded for Music Alive last season, just sort of reporting to each other about the residencies and how they went and so on. And at the end of that, Ed Harsh, who is the president of New Music USA, told us about this new iteration of the program. So they funded lots of orchestras. For instance, last year they funded like 17 different orchestras. Hmm. So basically what he said was, for the next 3 years, we're going to try something new. And we're going to fund only five orchestras for 3 years. And what we are looking to do is actually to embed a composer with an orchestra. To experiment, to demonstrate the impact of having a composer on the ground, pretty much as a member of your staff, over these 3 years, and what kind of impact that can have. And so it was a very competitive process that he described in order to get this, and it comes down to a handsome sum. It's like $250,000 over 3 years, and at least half of that goes to the composer, and the rest of it is administrative and so on and so forth. And so when he finished describing it, Jennifer and I looked at each other, and we both said, Jared Tate.
You knew right away. How come?
Well, because the way that the program is designed is to embed the composer,
yeah,
and to show significant new ways that not just the composer, but that music can have an impact on the community. So this goes hand in hand with the Bush Prize.
Right.
For us.
Right.
For community innovation, because we're talking about the creation of music and the performance of music, but we're also talking about using that as a tool for social change. And the Lakota Music Project has been a very successful venture over the last 7 years or so, but you know, we haven't actually been able to do that much. I mean, we performed that initial program probably 25 times or so over the last 6 or 7 years from various places and on, you know, 6 different reservations, 3 times at Crazy Horse, this and that and the other. But the fact is we're just, you know, constantly dependent upon whatever trickling funding can come in, right, in order to get out there and do it, the touring and all of that. Yeah. So now with the Bush Prize and this Music Alive residency, we can put some legs on this program and really see it have a deeper impact.
Yeah. So something
which is
like
what
this,
we've been looking for.
Something like this takes a lot of hard work. It takes a lot of conversation, but it also seems to me it takes a lot of imagination.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but and we're with it. We're in it with the Bush Foundation and with New Music USA.
Right.
I mean, they're both looking to experiment. Both of those organizations are, like, when we won the Bush Prize, I think we're the only arts organization that has ever been awarded the Bush Prize.
Really?
You know, the Bush Prize is not an arts thing. It's
sure.
it's
okay.
for community innovation. So most of the people who are getting these, well, most of them, you know, examples are like substance abuse programs,
right?
Backpack programs.
Sure.
You know, these are things where you say, well, of course they deserve to get funding because they're actually impacting the community in innovative ways.
So there's a responsibility for you there when we, you know, when you mention social change and innovation, and that's a real responsibility to sort of show up and say, yep, there was a reason that it worked.
Right. Absolutely. For the Bush, it was basically, they were recognizing the work that we'd already done.
Right.
They were
exactly.
saying, you know, you've done really cool stuff here.
Yeah.
Here's a gift. Go do more cool stuff.
What does this recognize?
Again, I think that it's building on what we've already done,
mm-hmm.
Enabling a relationship that already exists to grow much more. But also, awarding the innovation and putting faith in the ideas that spawned the innovation to begin with.
What do you think the potential impact of having a composer embedded with the orchestra could be on the musicians themselves? Do you have a sense of that?
Well, the obvious one for me is the interaction between Jarrett and Jeffrey Paul, for instance.
Right.
You know, I mean, Jeff has been composing music and working with Native Americans the whole time we've been part of this Lakota Music Project.
We should say,
so having the two composers interacting
right.
will be, you know, that's a no-brainer.
Right. We should say Jeffrey Paul, for those who don't know, principal oboist, jazz musician, mm-hmm. classical musician, and composer. So that's who we're talking about
yep.
there when we say Jeff Paul. What else?
Yeah. Well, it's kind of interesting looking back at the beginnings of, you know, like, almost 10 years ago, the beginnings of the Lakota Music Project, and we were fashioning this thing, and the musicians, the orchestra, you know, they came along, some of them reluctantly to begin with, you know, skeptically
right.
about, you know, what we could do, because, you know, they had gone out on the res and played programs for kids in schools and in the community in the past, and they always felt like, well, this is the white folks going out and you know, shoving their music down these people's throats. And there's, you know, there's bad history with that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people taking away drums and exchanging them for violins 100 years ago. And it's just like, you know, the history is not good on that front. So everybody felt a burden
right.
with that. So when we started fashioning this thing, I mean, we went in with the best of intentions, but there was some proving to be done on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
Of the equation, the Native side and the orchestra side too, and through this interaction and working with the Creekside Singers and Brian Akipa and the different people on the reservations, people at Crazy Horse, Sisseton, so on, the relationship has deepened, and everybody, at this point, everybody's on board.
Right.
Everybody's a believer. And so having Jared come and be part of the team, instead of just a visiting composer who's writing music for us to play, you know, one piece that we'll play, you know, several times, but actually having him traveling with us and creating music with us, like he'll write music specifically for our people
right.
to play, and specifically for, you know, the native artists, the Lakota artists that we have, you know, that I think will be very meaningful to a lot of people.
I want to ask you a personal question that's been kind of bouncing around my head ever since the Bush Prize and some of the recent conversations you and I have had. You are not afraid of enormous challenges. You are not afraid of innovation. You're not afraid, this is how I perceive you, you're not afraid of walking into a situation when you don't really know what the outcome is, but yet it kind of seems like you do, and the rest of us are just catching up. So I'm wondering, like, am I seeing you in the right way? Do you really just sort of march into this anxiety-free, take on the responsibilities? And if I'm right, where does that come from for you personally?
Well, Lori, I mean, honestly, what else am I going to do? You know, I mean, classical music in at this time in our culture is such a fringe thing. Like, people don't get the relevance of it.
But you could be happy on that fringe. And you're not. You could be a snob.
No, because it's not going to remain relevant.
Okay.
You know, like, kids aren't being taught about it in schools, you know? Like, you can get through your entire education and never hear a symphony of Beethoven and never even be told why it's important.
Sure.
You know, and which is ridiculous. I mean, you know, I keep hoping that we're going to get past this point in our, you know, the No Child Left Behind and Common Core and all this thing, get to a place where we're actually educating people to be human beings, which is what the humanities are all about, right?
Mm-hmm. Amen.
And how we can communicate with each other and actually, you know, build a common society together instead of just trying to compete economically with China. Oh boy, did you ever get me going now?
Yeah, right. No, keep going.
So, well, the thing is, like, the humanities, the arts, they impact people and relationships. Mm-hmm. I've seen it. I've lived it my entire life. And it can be done simply through the playing of a Beethoven symphony. Mm-hmm. People's lives can be incredibly impacted by, you know, by a symphony of Mahler or Don Giovanni by Mozart or something like that. But you have to open up the possibility. You have to create the space, and you have to have a relationship with people in order for that to happen. So one way of creating that space is by serving people and meeting them where they are and where their needs are. And so whether it's Lakota Music Project, which is meaningful both on the Lakota side and on the white side, people learn from each other, or whether it's music as medicine, going into the hospitals and you know, demonstrating music and the arts as part of the healing process and impacting not just patients but also doctors and staff.
Right.
You know, like, you know, making music in not just, you know, not just simply making music, but you have incredibly talented musicians that are devoted to what they do. They believe in the mission of what they do. They've known the impact of music in their own lives, and they're sharing it with other people. Mm. You know, going into the schools and you know, mentoring kids this way, our youth orchestra programs. I mean, this is music as an impactful tool. Yes, it's art for its own sake. Yes, and that's why I conduct, and that's why these musicians play. But we also know the potential for impact, for what happens when we share music together.
So you jump into these challenges because you have an understanding of reality. It's out of necessity, but do you also enjoy it?
Oh, of course I do. It's like the most fulfilling thing for me in the world. And honestly, personally, if I'm supposed to love my neighbor as I love myself, then maybe the best way I can begin that is by learning about what my neighbor loves and building that bridge, which is what the Lakota Music Project is all about.
Right.
Like sharing what we love and creating understanding and creating that space where we can actually begin to communicate. And, you know, and that's something politicians can't do.
That's Delta David Geyer, music director and conductor of South Dakota Symphony Orchestra. When we come back, a conversation with composer Jared Tate. You're in the moment, SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Composer Jared Tate is devoted to the development of American Indian classical composition. He embarks on a 3-year residency with South Dakota Symphony Orchestra, made possible by a grant from Music Alive. Jared and I have talked before when he visited Sioux Falls. This time, I caught up with him in his studios in Oklahoma City.
My name is Jared Impichachaha Tate.
I got this right from the last time we talked. Citizen of the Chickasaw Nation.
Yes.
I like hearing that. So you live in Oklahoma City, is that correct, or somewhere near there?
I live in Oklahoma City. So you said you like hearing that. I'm curious.
You know, you were the first person I had ever interviewed who said you were the citizen of a nation. I had heard all kinds of different ways of expressing cultural identity. I had never heard that way. So why identify yourself with those words now that we've started down that path?
I love talking about this because I think it's really informative and helpful for the general public to understand semantics, mm-hmm. you know, of Indian identity. And okay, so basically, there are, I think, I don't want to say three ways to identify your belonging to a tribe.
Mm-hmm.
One is called enrolled. That's you probably hear that term quite a bit, especially from where you're from, is because the Sioux still have active enrollment. And what that means is that you are entitled to land. And most, as far as I know, most enrollment, at least, I think all enrollment actually is completely dependent on blood quantum. So, from what I understand, most of the Lakota tribes have a blood quantum of, half or a quarter, something like that, before you're entitled to actual land on the reservation.
Okay.
So then after that, you are called, with like the Plains tribes, you're called a member of the tribe.
Mm-hmm.
And both circumstances mean you are literally a citizen of that nation, of that tribe. You are literally a citizen. So American Indians who have that your tribe, American Indians are have dual citizenship.
Okay, sure.
Like literally, so in my circumstance, and actually all of Oklahoma, we don't have reservations here. All that land was parceled back in the day during the Dawes rolls, and it was parceled out just before statehood in 1906. So the people who enrolled in 1906 are the only enrolled members of the tribe, and of course most have passed away.
Mm-hmm.
But what it means is that we are lineal descendants, and by our lineal descendancy, we are citizens of our own tribes. So anyway, Oklahoma has kind of a unique circumstance with that. So that's basically how that works.
That's interesting. Thank you for that.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Oh, sure. Yeah. So literally, I am literally a citizen of the Chickasaw Nation. It's the best way to describe. I'm not enrolled because the rolls closed in 1906. I'm not a member. I'm literally a citizen. And all the enrolled people in the Plains and members are also citizens, but they use the verbiage enrolled and members for their own purposes. So, yeah.
Yeah.
There you go.
There you go. And I alluded to it just a minute ago, but you have a connection to South Dakota before. You and I have had conversations before. I've written about you before. Give me a little bit of background on your connection to South Dakota.
Well, let's see here. I mean, with the symphony, I was just simply called, you know, one day back in 2009, because they were embarking on their new Lakota music project, in which they're deliberately doing a specific outreach to our Indian communities in South Dakota. Mm-hmm. And so they're looking for a handshake there. And of course, it's been going on for a number of years now. So anyway, I was invited to be a part of that project early on. And so I composed a work for the South Dakota Symphony for a solo baritone singer and orchestra, and the entire work is sung in the Lakota language. And that's something I do in my career. I like to use tribal languages in my pieces because I want to bring tribal languages into classical repertoire, just like French and German and Spanish and Italian, that kind of thing. And so, it's just the whole idea of tribal members sitting in an audience and hearing their language sung in an operatic fashion is really cool. I love that. It's a very romantic feeling. I have this romantic feeling about being Indian, and I love projecting legend and story and power on the stage. I just love it. Just no different than Puccini does. There's a passion to express your identity, and I love doing that for Indian country. I love doing that for them. Yeah,
very much part of the classical music tradition for composers to be linked very strongly with a national identity. Correct?
Absolutely, absolutely.
You taught me that. That's straight from the
left. it's really funny because when I was growing up and playing the piano, I just didn't put it together for myself. And here I'm playing Prokofiev, I'm playing Chopin, and these people and Debussy and Beethoven, and they all strongly identified with their nationality, and we know them as Debussy is French, and Beethoven is German, Prokofiev is Russian. And, all that kind of, Scarlatti is Italian. It's like, there's a national identity for all of those great composers. Amy Beach is an American composer. Mm-hmm. I mean, stuff like that. And Toro Takemitsu is Japanese. And we all know that. We all know their identities. So I realized that I could be a part of that, that history. And it's just a very exciting thing to do. I just love bringing Indian presence into classical history.
When do you think you made that connection? Were you quite young at the piano making that connection, or did you have to age into that a little bit?
I had to age into it. Like I said, when I was learning repertoire, I just took all that for granted. I did not see my Indian identity and my classical identity having anything to do with each other. And it wasn't until my Irish mother commissioned me for a ballet score back in 1991, and I was graduating college from Northwestern University. I was finishing my degree there, and she asked me to compose the score for her ballet, and it was a ballet that was had several stories from tribes from the Northern Plains and Rockies. So, as I grew up in mom's rehearsals, I grew up in the theater. I grew up in all of her rehearsals. I was in them. I played for them. I sang, I acted, I did all this stuff with my mother as a kid. And my father is both my parents were completely involved in theater. So I grew up in that environment. And so it was very natural for mom to look at me and go, "Well, you're Indian. You're my son, and you know exactly what I want to do." It's like, I know her process. It was like a perfect fit. And at first it really kind of threw me because I didn't see myself like that. But my very first composition was a ballet. And mom did that. And so I look back on it, and I was so much younger then. But I look back and after the whole thing premiered. We toured it around Wyoming and South Dakota. Mm-hmm. And, you know, because there was all kinds of Lakota stories as well. I mean, there was just, it was all in that area. All the stories were in that area. And when we got done with the project, I remember sitting back in a chair and going, wow, what do I do now?
What's next?
It just redefined me. I didn't expect something like that to come into my life. And the other thing that really was a very, very strong influence on this was we had a narrator that narrated we had a storyteller in the ballet. Mm-hmm. And he would come on stage and do narrations and this kind of thing intermittently. And his name is Rodney Grant, and he's Omaha. Mm-hmm. And he was one of the big stars from Dances with Wolves. And Dances with Wolves had just come out when we were doing this. And so we were just looking at all the credits and seeing, wow, dreaming about who we would want to come and be the narrator. And Rodney accepted the gig. And, you know, he just was straight up. He's like, Jared, you are a Chickasaw classical composer. And he was like, that's amazing. And you've got to pursue this.
Yeah.
And I was nervous. I wasn't sure. Just, you know, but he was just like, man, you gotta do this. and so, you know, and Rodney had done a lot of work with youth in Indian country and everything. And he did it during the tour, and I was able to witness that. But he was just like, man, you gotta do this.
Yeah.
And that was really, really critical. So when I got off, you know, composing, then what I did is I had to take the semester off from graduate school so I could do this project. I went back and added composition to my degree program. Mm-hmm. And my composition teacher was Donald Erb, and then the rest is history. Just ever since then, I've literally every piece I've composed has been commissioned.
How do you how do you stretch yourself and measure yourself? Classical music has such an intense history. How does a young American composer be heard in a contemporary society that with all that background and that history around you?
What?
I don't know. Is that a weird question?
Small question.
Yeah. Okay.
Epic questions. Let's hear. Let me see if I can give an epic answer.
Right. Sorry.
You know, admittedly, classical music is not pop music. It's not the same. And, you know, so the audience and the frequency of hearing is a different ball game.
Right.
Completely different. And I think what's the most important thing to discuss with younger composers is the need to connect. And I do this with my kids. I taught composition to Indian kids all over the country, and I always take them for exactly who they are. I don't impose what I'm doing in classical music. I just like, this is you. How do you want to express yourself in a string quartet?
Mm-hmm.
And I make sure that to coach them in a way that they have a message that feels cohesive. And so I think what's really, really critical in any artistic expression is the most intense connection you can have. Like it's got to be desperate to connect. if that makes any sense. And you know, of course, you know, that's very counter to a lot of the, you know, we're still suffering the consequences of the 50s with, you know, with the beat society that's like, I don't care what you think and all this kind of stuff. And it's like, well, you know, any composer who says they don't care what somebody thinks about their music is lying. It's not true that you wouldn't compose music if you did not want to connect with somebody because you're projecting. That's the whole purpose of it is to share who you are with people because you feel that what you're feeling is important. So it's, I guess for young composers, I think identity is always legitimate. Whatever your identity is very legitimate. We all have one wonderfully personal and diverse experiences, and bringing that expression into your music in a very like desperate way, I think is the attitude I like to see composers have.
Do you stay hungry and passionate and desperate, if you will, after years of doing that work? How do you fuel that energy on a daily basis?
You know, it's well, I mean, you know, I'm a normal human being, and sometimes I get tired. I do have a family, and I'm raising a 3-year-old, and so I'm exhausted.
Right.
So, I mean, there's an absolute place of normalcy, you know, in this profession. But at the same time, the only reason I do it is because I'm driven by this romantic vision, it's so cool because it's an endless well of reason. Mm-hmm. Just the fact that you want to do something is endless, and there's always a new way to do this or a new project to discover and a new, you know, there's always a way to find something that's new and fresh for yourself. And I love that. Every time I talk about a new project with somebody, I'm like, oh, you know what would be cool if we did this, you know, and that's
yeah.
Like, not a very intelligent way to say it, but it's like, you know, but it's really about the cool factor. It's like, what would be cool, you know? And that's fun, and it really is endless. And if you look at human history, humans have been just doing cool stuff for a very, very long time. And it's endless how we can find new ways of expressing all of that. It's just endless. I don't see a timeline on this. It just goes forever. It's awesome.
And so give me an idea of, as a parent who has had a 3-year-old, I get what a day with a 3-year-old is like. What a day as a composer is like. Give me some highlights. You don't have to me through your whole day, but give me some highlights of be in that world.
Very good question. Very good question. Okay. Well, I am a composer, and I also manage my own profession. Mm-hmm. So I am my own manager. So I'm doing this radio interview with you because I'm the only one that can do it. So right. I'm literally managing my career by talking to you.
Okay. Got it.
And so there's all, you know, there's emails, phone calls, all that kind of stuff, because you know, I've got to be employed. And so I've got to talk to people, you know, and so it's actually quite similar to anybody who's in a freelance industry of anything. There's the creative part and there's the managing part. So those two aspects have to be in a good balance for you to move ahead. So then of course, you know, as I'm managing blah, 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 well, I've got to compose. And so what I've found is the ideal, beautiful vision is like, oh, I will compose for 4 hours, and then I will do emails for 1 hour, and I will do phone, you know, that kind of thing. But it doesn't happen.
Oh, thank goodness!
It's like a lot of spurts of energy, and so so sometimes what I do is I just close down the phone and emails, and I just got to compose for months, or you know, or a week. You know, it depends on what's going on, but I just have to focus because. You have to be in that environment. So I'm the kind of person who just has to do one big thing at a time. And so it's challenging. It's just a challenging balance of managing myself and creating art. And I gotta tell you, I'm going to go on a tangent. It's really amazing because every time I finish a score, you know, I write manuscripts. I do it by hand. And then I put the score into the computer and then make parts, that kind of thing, professional things. For the ensembles, but I'm sitting here looking at my scores, going, I don't remember writing any of that. The 40-minute oratorio. Oh, I wrote that.
That was me.
did I do that? and so it's like those zones are really hard to describe. That when you're in your zone, it's wonderful and you're productive, and then when you get out of it, you're doing something else. So anyway, I'm not being really specific here, but
yeah.
I guess
place exists for you. It's a real place to go.
So I'm constantly toggling back and forth between my creative environment and my business environment.
Composer Jared Tate is in residency next season with the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra. When we come back, a South Dakota high school sophomore's jazz composition seeks a national stage. Annalise Levesque is after the break. You're in the moment. SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. Sioux Falls Lincoln Senior High School sophomore Annalise Levesque recently won a composition competition. She won the West Central Division of the contest sponsored by the Music Teachers National Association. Now her work goes on to the national stage. We caught up with Levesque in Sioux Falls when she and the other musicians were off school for the holiday break to talk more about jazz, friendship, and the creative soup that is high school in South Dakota.
They're my closest friends. Some of them are a little younger than me, and one of them's a little older. But we've known each other for like 3 or 4 years. We just like getting together and hanging out and playing music together because it's something we like to do.
This is a jazz band.
Yeah, it's a jazz combo because it's a smaller group and we do more soloing.
So give me an idea if you play just in school, outside of school?
We mostly play outside of school. It's just something we do on our own. But we did play in the talent show at school this year, so that was fun.
How did it get started?
One of my friends texted me. He said, hey, we should start a jazz combo with some of our other friends. And I was like, oh, that's a good idea. So we invited like 3 people over and we just jammed for a little bit, but it didn't really work. And we were like, oh, we need more people. So then we invited more people and we made our own arrangements and we bought some arrangements and we just played. And now it's what it is.
What made this one take off and gel like it did? Because you play really well together. You can tell you've played together a lot.
Well, thank you. I think it's just of the chemistry between us. We're just close friends and it's something we like to do. Like, we've done it together in school and at camps before, and we just know how we operate and we just work together really well and we know each other and it's just fun. So
now let's talk about the contest. Explain this contest to me.
In September, I wrote a song. Well, actually I wrote the song way earlier, but we entered the song in September and we sent it in and we waited for the results. And basically how the contest works is you send in the composition, and first it's at a state level, and at the state level, there was no other people in my age group, so I automatically advanced to the regional competition. And the regional competition consists of 8 states. I can't remember what they all are, but it's like the Midwest. And then if you get first at the regional competition, you automatically advance, and I happen to win that. And so the competition is just people write songs, and you enter them, and the judges judge them, and they give you feedback, and then it's just, yeah.
What happens next?
Now we're just waiting. I think we find out by the end of January how it works at the national competition, but I'm just competing against the finalists from the 6 other regions to find out who's the winner.
Do you have to go to the national competition and play live, or do they listen to the recording to judge you?
They listen to like a recording that we sent in at the beginning, but if I win, then I go to Baltimore, Maryland to play and live.
And you bring the whole group?
I probably won't bring the group because that'd be a lot of people, but my dad knows people who works with Yamaha there, so we're just going to get people to play there.
Let's talk about your dad, and because he's playing in the group today. Tell me about sort of his influence as a musician in your life.
Well, he is like one of the best musicians I know, and like he's like just so good, and he knows almost everything about jazz, and he's taught me everything I know about jazz, like about soloing and chords, and I've learned everything from him, so I honestly owe it all to him. He's just a really great musician, and he's inspired me a lot to like write songs, and he's the one who gave me the software to write the song on, so that was also why I owe that to him, too.
All right, does he intimidate you? Do you feel the pressure of that?
A little bit. Like, sometimes when I don't do things quite the way he wants it to be his way, but we work out our differences.
And how have you found your own voice? Because clearly you have, or are at the beginning stages of finding your own voice.
I think I'm just getting there, honestly. Like, some of the arrangements I've written, including that one, I'm not the happiest with, so I'm going to go back and, like, change them. And it's just, like, I think of songs in my head, and I write them down, and then I think of better ways to make them, and it just, I want to be the best I can be, and I think I'm just tapping into that.
You're listening to it, and you're finding things that you want to adjust. When you listen to other people's compositions, do you want to rewrite them a little bit, too?
Well, sometimes I do, but lots of times I take ideas that other people have used and like to like implement the idea or concept into my own composition because I like how it sounds and it's like something I want to reflect. And I think my style is just a bunch of other styles that I like put together in a unique way.
How do you sit down to write a new composition?
Well, I don't write anything unless I know what I'm going to write. Like, The idea for this composition, I was just sitting on a summer day one time and I thought of the melody and I went and plinked it out on the piano and then I figured out some chord progressions to go with it and I wrote like a general like skeleton copy of it of like what the chords would be and what the melody would be. And then about a year later, I went in and I picked out the instruments I wanted and then I wrote out the song. And I just do whatever comes to mind. Like, I have a general idea of how I want the instruments to play between each other. And then I just, like, I'll try something out, and if I like it, then I'll keep it. But if I don't like it, then I'll delete it, and I'll think. And until I find something that I want to use, I'll just wait, because I don't want to put something I don't know what I'm doing in it.
What's it like to then have the musicians play the song and you're starting to hear it for the first time?
Well, first I've noticed that not everybody thinks the exact way that I do. And so I'm like, don't do it like that. Do it the way I want to do it. And they're like, why? I'm like, well, it's my song. But it, like, some people have their own styles and I like that. And it's like all up to interpretation. And it's really cool to hear your song being played like by a group, because it's like, wow, I wrote that. It was from my head. Yeah. It's crazy.
Does it sound like it sounded in your head?
Yeah.
You're a writer too. How alike are those two creative processes?
I think they're actually pretty alike. I've never thought of that before, but it's just like an idea you have in your head, and it's kind of already written, but you have to make it in its own, like, physical form. Like, I have ideas for stories in my head, and I know how they're going to end. You have to work out all the details and how it's going to be interpreted by other people, and it's just like you wanted to get... I saw this quote one time. It was something along the lines of, like, art is not how you see things, but how you make others see things. And it's, I think it's how I make others hear my songs or, like, read my stories. It's just how I want, how other people see my ideas in my head.
Do you have a future in the arts, do you think? Is that something you want to continue to pursue, or is it just part of the many things that you're interested in at this point?
Right now, I have no idea. I want to do it, like, for the rest of my life. I want to be a musician and be a writer. But I don't know what my main focus is going to be in my life, so I guess I'll find out.
Because you're an athlete, too.
Yeah.
How does that fit into the creative process, running?
Well, running, for me, is, like, really, I don't know what the word would be. It's kind of, like, it sets me free. And so, like, when I'm running, I'm just kind of in, like, a state where I can think about whatever I want. And I don't have to think about anything else because I'm in total control of my body. And my mind gets kind of idle. And so I get lots of my ideas, like, while I'm running for stuff. Like, I get ideas for stories while I'm running. I get ideas for... songs, and because my mind is just idle and it does whatever it wants, and my best ideas come from then.
Are you ever out at a cross-country meet and you're wishing that you had your notebook with you, or something, you want to stop and write something down?
Yeah, it's happened before. Like, I think, like, sometimes when I'm running races, I, like, think of, like, songs, and I think of, like, and, like, it just comes to my head, and I just think of it, like, based on how I'm running. Like, the beat on my steps works into, like, the tempo of the song and stuff.
When you look around at your classmates in high school, do you see a lot of the similar kind of creative buoyancy and creative expression, or are you unique amongst your peers?
Oh, I think, like, some of my friends definitely had the same ideas I do. And, like, in English class, for example, when we're, like, we do peer reviews of other people's stories, and when I read other people's stories, I'm just like, why didn't I think of that? And I'm just like, I just like to be immersed in, like, all this talent, because it just gives me more ideas. And I think I'm definitely not alone. There's so many people out there.
Who inspires you in the world of jazz as far as composers or musicians that you've heard of and experienced and sort of speak to you?
Well, I have lots of, like, favorite artists that I like to listen to, but I think my dad is the main guy.
How come? Do you hear him play? Yeah. Like, what's your earliest memory of hearing music in your house?
Just... I don't know. There isn't an early summary because it's always been there.
Break the song down for me. Break it down into, does it have components? If I read a short story of yours, I would understand sort of the narrative flow. Can I understand the narrative flow of a jazz song?
For some jazz songs, there's definitely, like, ups and downs and stuff. But I think this one's just, like, sitting on the beach, watching the waves crash up and the white sand between your toes.
What's the key to being a good improvisational musician?
Well, music isn't, like, a thing, but it's actually a language, and when you understand the language, you can just, like, be fluent in it. Like, when you're fluent in a language, you speak and it, like, flows beautifully. And when you're fluent in the language of jazz and music, then when you solo, it speaks beautifully.
How do you want the audience to walk away from this song after they've heard it?
I just want them to be, like, relaxed and, like, feeling good about life and happy and upbeat, just like, wow, like, that was good, like, you're full and complete.
That's Annalise Levesque. The Jazz Combo performed her award-winning composition for you. It's a Latin tune called La Playa. We're going to let them play us out of the show, but first we'll play the song, we'll take a break, and then we'll bring you in our second hour the latest in state news. And coming up in the second hour of In the Moment, We talk with Dan Ahlers about the upcoming legislative session. SDPB's Keely Boltina introduces you to the Milken Educator Award winner. And plus, we have a Vera mental health counselor, Jim Green. He's going to talk about the small steps in relationships that help exact meaningful change and self-worth in your life. You're in the moment with SDPB Radio. And once again, Annalise Levesque and her jazz combo. The song is called La Playa. Enjoy.